Welcome, Alan.
No, thanks.
To the Friends Reformin Animation Forum podcast.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
You know where we are again.
Brooklyn. What's up?
Back in the studio.
What? Back in the studio in Brooklyn. What?
We have been all throughout this land of ours in different capacities.
All over the globe, it
seems.
We've
been to Canada.
Yeah.
We've been to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
We've been to the kitchen to get snacks.
Yeah.
Alan's cat's meowing. It is very adorable.
Let me close her out of it.
Oh. Alan is going to take his cat out. That's what he said. I don't know what he means by that. Sometimes people, you know, take people out, meaning, you know, swim with the fishies. Which, I don't know. I think lately we've been allowing ourselves to say fishies instead of fish as the plural for a single fish. Alan, what do you think about that?
Well, I think it's kind of weird because people are always fishing for ideas.
Exactly. You know what I think?
What's that?
I think that the cheddar fish.
Yeah.
They are not as delicious.
I know.
As real fish.
Yeah.
That's right, Alan. I know. The cheddar fish do not have the same salty taste.
You've been talking this whole time?
What?
Are you still talking? Huh. Hey, that light bulb above you is making a horrible noise.
There's a light bulb above me? That's just my idea.
Sorry, I had to give you the cat some snacks. And
that's okay. Cat snacks.
Bring us our own snack.
Oh. That's the sound of snacks.
This, Joel.
Yeah?
This is damn good jerky.
Alan has handed me a piece of what looks like shoe leather.
Upstate New York. You put it in your mouth and you chew on it.
I just put it in my ear, should I?
Well, you shouldn't put it in your ear. You should put it in your mouth.
Wow. Holy crap.
Not good.
How was that generated?
I don't know.
What animal does this come from?
I don't know. It doesn't matter. It's delicious.
You hear that?
Mm-hmm.
It's the sound of me chewing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Wow, this is good.
Isn't that damn good?
Alan, what are we eating?
Damn good jerky.
This is damn good jerky.
I know.
What is the official title of this jerky?
Damn good beef jerky.
And where does it come from?
It comes from Stillwater, New York.
Is that bad? Good. Because usually water that is like a puddle could have a lot of disease in it.
I think it's just the name of the place. It has nothing to do with the water there.
Okay. Don't you get, is it Giardia?
You want some more jerky?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
It's so good.
Yeah.
I don't care if it's filled with
salt.
Maggotosis.
Ooh.
Mmm. Mmm. Holy crap.
I know.
It's like eating a bit of a cloud.
Mmm.
It's like eating an angel's shoelace.
Mmm.
Mmm. Mmm. Well.
Yeah. Let's get down to business here.
Alan, it seems to me that our show, this show, the Frenzer Foreman Animation Forum.
Yeah, what about it?
Costco jerky.
What about it? Yeah, it is good, isn't it?
It started off at a very fast pace.
Yeah.
It was a week to week to week.
Sprint, baby.
Sprint. We were just going, and then we started to have bigger gaps between episodes.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know what's good about all that?
What?
We've been busy in the world.
Really busy in the world.
Many projects. So we've kind of decided, hey, why not just make it month to month?
Yeah. A little more manageable, given our busy, busy, important lives.
Yeah.
It's not that the podcast is an important part of our lives, but, you know, there are other things that we need to give our attentions to.
Like what?
You know, the stuff of life that makes life happen. Sex.
You're talking about making babies.
Making a lot of dirty babies.
Yeah, yeah. I just talked to my dad this week, and he gave me the sex talk.
Did he? How did it go? Phone. What did he say?
He said, son, when a man and a woman, or a woman and a woman, or a man and a man,
or a man and a donkey,
man or a donkey, or a donkey and a
woman,
or a woman donkey,
and a giraffe,
cricket,
mm-hmm.
or a rock and a dead donkey.
So it was a long talk then.
He kind of went on with relationship possibilities for a good 7 hours.
And then what happened?
Love each other.
Love each other very much.
Very much. Yeah. Very much.
Yeah.
I'm glad we could have this talk. And he hung up the phone.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
How did that make you feel?
Kind of excited. But Alan.
Anyways.
So we're making a monthly podcast now.
Mm-hmm.
And because our lives are filled with other things.
Yeah.
And you have been working on many projects.
That's right. Doing a lot of work.
Being an animator in the world.
I know. Animating and directing.
Oh.
A lot of fun. Yeah.
Directing animation or traffic?
Directing mostly traffic, but the occasional animation job.
Because you're in a pretty busy street. You could just lean out the window.
That's why I have these white gloves on.
Are you ever like a singing or whistling cop?
No, I play guitar while I direct traffic.
So different chords mean different people could go across the street.
Well, different songs.
Oh, different songs.
Yeah.
What's the song you would play for right lane stop, left lane go?
That would be Wake Up Little Susie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What about you stop, you folks walk across the street?
Only the lonely.
Okay. Yeah, I see. I've been busy too.
Yeah, what have you been doing?
I have been teaching children how to animate.
Jesus.
This week.
Yeah.
I did that as a workshop in New York City.
How'd that work?
It was perfect. Yeah. No problems.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the kids were like angels.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They made a great little film. It's going to be in the New York International Children's Film Festival.
Oh, excellent. Coming up. When does that happen?
Well, in March, the month that this episode is being released.
Oh, my God.
March 2011.
Yeah.
Okay. For those out there who did not know. We have a great show today.
Yeah, really do.
Now, we have a whole catalog of interviews.
Oh, God.
As you might know.
Mm-hmm.
Is this annoying to hear us chew jerky and talk at the same time?
I think it sounds excellent.
We have a catalog.
We do have a catalog.
Of infinite interviews. I think we labeled it infinite interviews.
I thought it was supposed to be intimate.
Oh. I thought it was infinite. We talking about infinity?
I don't know.
They're very closely related.
They are.
And we are going to tap into that for this episode. Some might say, when you hear this, hey, they're in Los Angeles again? Wow, they must be flying back and forth all of the time. Those jet setters.
Well, we are.
The podcast.
Yeah.
And the truth is, that's exactly what we've done. We just keep going back and forth between the coasts, interviewing people.
Yeah.
This is in no way part of what we recorded last summer in LA.
No, this is
brand new. We were brought back to the Animation World Network headquarters building.
Mm-hmm.
Same scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Treated like royalty.
Oh, yeah.
Ron Diamond rolled out an actual red carpet, put a fur coat on me, gave Alan a scepter.
Fucking scepter.
We walked on a craft table full of sushi.
Mm-hmm.
That was
laid out on naked women.
Laid out on naked women,
mm-hmm.
Who were holding avocado martinis as we walked by.
And there was one of those water dispensers, but it was champagne.
A champagne dispenser?
Yeah.
They had a martini fountain.
Mm-hmm.
They had a vodka fountain.
Isn't that sort of the same thing?
They had
bourbon bubble bath.
They had a bourbon bubble bath.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of this long parade were two microphones and a recording device.
Yeah.
And then a whole waiting room full of famous people.
Yeah.
That we could just pick at random.
Pick out whoever we wanted.
That's usually how it goes when we go there.
Yeah.
So, today's episode features animation musician Michael Markman.
Yeah.
Plus teaching duo, marriage duo, and animators.
Yeah.
Sheila Sofian and David Fain. Computer, take us there now.
Wait, we have to do the...
Let's bring him in, Michael Markman.
Yeah, let's hear it for him.
Yay.
Woo! Yeah,
it's funny. Yourself. It's funny that we're bringing him into his own house.
I know. It's weird that he let us kick him out for a week.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
What are you gonna do?
So, Michael Markman, we are very pleased to have you on our podcast.
Yes. Thanks for letting us come to your home.
The theme, music, composition for animation. Is that correct?
It is.
What do you do specifically in that arena?
Well, it started off about, I'd say about 10, 15 years ago with the actual Tiny Toons at Warner Brothers. And that was Bruce Broughton was the composer, and he had a studio orchestra of about 35 people at Warner Brothers. And it got so hot that everybody wanted it. Everybody wanted it into the orchestra as well. And it got so busy for Bruce that he started developing a stable of composers. And by the time we were done with all the spin-offs and Animaniacs, Freakazoid, mm-hmm. Pinky mm-hmm. and the Brain, and all of that, I've done actually around 400 double sessions.
Wow.
On the music for animation. Plus, I do Simpsons as well.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's all done in this area.
Done in L.A.
Okay.
Simpsons is done at Fox most of the time, unless the stage is busy with some other project. And if it is, we go to an independent studio someplace else. And all the Animaniacs was 99% done at Warner Brothers. But the best sound, I think, of all the stages is MGM, Sony.
Now, are you, just to make it clear, are you playing instruments?
I play only one instrument.
And what is?
Violin.
Okay.
Right.
And you've okay. been playing violin for how long now?
Literally since I was 7 years old. So I'm now 62. So yeah. professionally since I was about 19 or 20. So 42 years.
It's a long roughly. Time. Yeah. Yeah.
So with something like the Animaniacs or Tiny Toons, mm-hmm. which is dependent on musical cues all the time.
Right.
Music being sound effects for a lot of what they do. Were they also doing Foley sound effects at the same time with the orchestra?
No. Okay. Sound effects was last.
Okay.
But music was the integral part of that show.
Yeah.
Without question. We recorded like Tuesday and Thursday, 10 to 6 each day or 10 to 5 each day with our overtime if we needed it. And it was all just the cues. For maybe two episodes, because they were, what, half-hour shows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were 22 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a great job.
Were you given creative freedom to use the violin to improv with it at all?
There were times where the concertmaster, depending who it was, and sometimes that was a mistake, actually. I'll get into that in a second. If they wanted the concertmaster to improvise, like a jazz violin kind of thing, or a classical solo, it had to be the right concertmaster for that. But Richard and his staff eventually knew the orchestra and knew everything they did and how well they did it and where their expertise was, and he would write for that. So I was not concertmaster of that orchestra, but I was asked to be, and there were political issues at stake and close friends in the balance, and we just left it being in the section was fine with me. There was only 8 violins on it anyway. I think it was 8 violins, 2 cellos, two violas. Well, on Simpsons, we have 12 fiddles, 12 violins, three violas, 3 cellos and a bass, and the bass doubles on Fender.
Right, right.
And then winds and brass.
Wow.
Two synths. One's a piano synth double, a synth strictly for sounds that the composer wants, and about 2 or 3 guys in percussion.
Wow. Jesus, yeah. That's a big orchestra.
And guitar and bass and Fender. Yeah.
When they, for the fiddles or the violin section,
right.
When they want a particular sound for a cue for Tiny Toons or Animaniacs.
Uh-huh.
Was that something that the composer had to be really creative about, how they would blend together to create a certain sound?
Yes, it was. They had to decide if it was a single line melody or a single line underscore, or it would be a divisi underscore, meaning harmonizing within the own section, their own section, plus adding the viola and cello.
Do you need to know how to speak Italian to play violin?
No.
Okay. It seems all the terminology is in Italian.
All the terminology comes with the growing in with the instrument from a very early age.
Right.
But there are composers who make up names.
Oh,
I had one the other day, something called bruscamente.
And what's that mean?
No one knows what it means. So they decide on the spot what it is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Add more stromboli.
Yeah, add more stromboli. More stromboli and a lot more pescatori.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And don't get too fusilli.
I have a funny story about pasta.
Please.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I was in Europe with the LA Philharmonic on a tour. I went to Cremona because my violin is a copy of a great violin that was owned by Niccolo Paganini. And that violin was in Genoa. But I was in Cremona. And so I got on a train, took all this adventure by myself, of course, without speaking the language. Ended up in Genoa and found out where the place was, where the violin was. And I got there and it was a town hall in Genoa. And they wouldn't let me in because there was a town meeting. So I asked I guess it was a cop, where was a really good Italian restaurant, which is kind of silly asking him when I'm standing in Genoa, you know, where Christopher Columbus was. And he said there was this great place. I go down this alley, turn left and take a right. And I found this place and I walk in and I'm the only person in it because it's like around 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, yeah.
We're all sleeping.
Yeah.
It's break time. I come in and I ask them if they were closed. I mean, in my very meager Italian, I was able to find out that they're never closed.
Hmm.
So they said, what do you do? And I said, I'm a violinist. I'm traveling with the LA Philharmonic. Oh, my God, a violinist in our restaurant. And they finally asked me if I ever worked with Pavarotti. And I said, I had. Oh, that was it. They hooked me in the back.
Wow.
They started showing me, you know, Vitello di Lombata, which is veal chops like you never saw before. They took me and showed me where they were making the pasta, the tagliatelle, whatever it was called. And then the questions continued, and they said, what about Sinatra? Did you ever work with Frank Sinatra? I said, oh, many times. Oh, that was it. Get the owners from the back, get a picture, and my picture's on the wall in this restaurant with the owners because I worked with Frank Sinatra.
Wow. So what projects did you work on with both those people?
With Sinatra?
With Sinatra
I did
Pavarotti.
A lot of work with Frank Sinatra. Oh, God, what a period of time that was.
Yeah.
Well, my wife and I lived in Las Vegas for 5 years. And before coming to LA, and we played, when people say, well, when were you there? Well, I say, well, we were in Vegas when there was only one name on every marquee.
Wow.
Elvis, Frank, Dean, Sammy, you know, those were the greats of the time. And we worked for all of them.
Wow.
But my one big Sinatra story before I came to LA was, I guess there was a concert master at Caesar's Palace that wasn't very good. It's kind of old. Been there a long time, and Frank came in with his show, and there was a bunch of violin solos. And he wasn't happy, because he was very, very discerning about his musicians. And the band leader over there called the band leader where I was, which was MGM, the new MGM back then. And they said, you got a great concert master there, because I need somebody bad over here. So they made arrangements, and I would go over to Caesars in between my shows with Dean Martin or Shecky Green or whoever I was working for and play Frank's show. And Marvin Hamlisch was opening for Frank. And he had the Rhapsody in Blue he was playing with the big violin solo, you know, the slow section. And Frank heard it. He says, I need this guy. This is the guy I want playing Concertmaster. So anyway, I had to do it. So
wow.
I was
doing four shows
a day.
Of course. You don't turn that down.
Yeah. I don't want to wake up with a horse's head in my head. Frank, that was fantastic. So from then on, I did a lot of work live with him, with, you know, the great music, the great band charts that he had. And then after we left Vegas to raise a family here in LA, then I did a lot of albums with him. Duets 1, Duets 2, those were all with Frank in the studio at Capitol.
Yeah.
And then I saw him again. The last time I saw him was when Streisand made her comeback on the Millennium.
Right.
2000, she opened the new MGM Grand. I was brought into Vegas from LA with Streisand. And so we were coming down for the performance. I got out of the elevator. I'm walking in the backstage area, and Sinatra's in the other theater. And he sees me. He says, kid, come here. Come in the room. Come on, get in here. I said, I got to go do this. She'll wait. Get in here. So I went in, and his producer was a very close friend of mine from the Paul Anka days. And I went in and, you know, we had a drink and this and that. And he's talking about what am I doing now and this and that. And I said, I've been in L.A. for, you know, 4 or 5 years now or 10 years. And he said, well, tell Babs I said hello. And if you're late, tell her it's my fault. And I said, no, I'll be okay. And right about a month after that, we started duets back in L.A. So that was the last time I saw Frank. And he is really missed.
So very interesting career. From what you're doing with Sinatra to animation, What was that like as a transition for you?
That's a good question. Yeah.
How did you get there?
There's a progression, actually, in this field of commercial music. There is definitely a progression. You start, you know, doing what they call casuals, which are concerts where you're in the section, where you're, you know, playing with unknowns that have money for an orchestra of some kind. And then you get to a place like, in my career, like Vegas, and all of a sudden you start working with all these big stars. I'm talking about in the late 70s. I mean, you get on a stage and out comes Sammy Davis Jr. I mean, that's the ultimate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Sinatra and even Dean Martin. That's the ultimate live music there was back then. The biggest extravaganza that I ever played was Donna Summer when she was the queen of disco thing and all those great disco hits of hers. She came into the MGM Grand. I never saw anything like it. People were literally on top of the tables in this sophisticated showroom.
Yeah.
It never happened before. I mean, I've been all over the place. I played with Elvis. Playing with Elvis was one of the highlights of my life.
Tell us your best Elvis story. This is fascinating.
Yeah.
We'll get to animation eventually.
Yeah, we'll get there.
We're still in Vegas at the moment.
Timeline, you know.
Elvis was unbelievable. He would invariably treat the musicians like they were the stars. He gave, I think he used to write a check for about $5,000 to be divided by the musicians as a tip.
Wow.
Every time he appeared.
Wow.
He was just incredibly generous. But the main story you asked me, the famous Elvis story was, that I recall at the moment, he had a toothache one night, a real bad toothache. And it was in the middle of the night, it's 2:00 in the morning. And so they didn't know what to do about it. And it was killing him. So one of the viola players in the orchestra at the Hilton's brother was a doctor. So they called the viola player. Said, can you get your brother on the phone? Got an emergency. So it's like 2:00 a.m. The guy's old already, the viola player. But he did. He got his brother, and the brother came over to the hotel and he went upstairs and gave Elvis a shot of Novocaine. And where the tooth was, and he said, look, you got to go to the dentist tomorrow morning as soon as you wake up because I'm not a dentist. I'm not going to pull the tooth or work on it or do anything, but I give you a shot of Novocaine. So they did. And the pain went away, and Elvis was like a little baby again, a little kid. And the next day, this doctor goes to work, comes out of his office, and there's a brand new Cadillac convertible with a big bow on it.
Whoa.
We should have been doctors.
Yeah. For him.
Wow.
And that was one of the best, you know, stories.
Wow.
God.
So, computer has a question.
Oh, computer, go ahead.
Yeah, he's being kind of quiet in the back here.
Computer, yes.
He's a little embarrassed. Yeah. Okay, so computer wants to know if you could work with anybody now that you haven't worked with yet, who would that be? And he's whispering. He really hopes it's Justin Bieber, but, you know, we'll let you.
Computer.
Hears this thing.
It's a tough question from the computer. I mean, Justin Bieber, what is he, about 10?
Yeah,
I think so. I think he's 9.
10 or 9, 9 or 10. Yeah, no, I don't think he's ready for a string section.
But no, really, you know, is there anyone that you would?
There are some really great, talented young people out there, and give me some examples.
Well,
Christina Aguilera.
I've done some record dates with her.
Okay.
Oh, yeah?
But nothing live, and I hear she's in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Canceling the concert tour. They only cancel for one reason.
You too.
There's no strings in that.
No.
Yeah, no, they don't do strings.
Lady Gaga. Beyonce.
Lady Gaga, you know, Beyonce has charged with strings.
Yeah.
But Gaga, you know, that hype is beyond belief.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
And actually, she's a pretty talented, pretty smart lady. And to get as far as she has, from what she's achieved.
Yeah. What was it like working with the great Tito Jackson?
You know, they live right around the corner from here.
Really?
Yeah.
Right. A lot of the Jacksons live right around here.
And when the Jackson 5 was working, they were fantastic to work with. They had great personalities. There was no drugs of any kind. Wouldn't even think of it.
Was Joe the drug?
Joe, the father, was the drug.
Hmm.
And I think when they got a little bit older, Tito and some of the other, they just ignored him and just did their thing. But he's the one that put it together.
Yeah.
No question.
Yeah.
I remember Michael when he was like nine years old or so. I was just telling you in the other room, dribbling a basketball on the stage at MGM. Couple of days left to their gig at with the Jackson 5, and we were having a little pass back and forth, and then I saw him again, you know, much later in the studio.
Still dribbling a ball?
Yeah, still dribbling. Still dribbling, signing, making us all sign, you know, statements that say we wouldn't repeat anything we saw.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
In the studio. Yeah. Wow. Or heard.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Are those still binding?
Oh my God.
Didn't see anything, don't know anything. Yeah, you know, yeah. That was the thing with Elmer Bernstein. That was the history album.
Alan, go. I wanted to find out more about how you get from playing in orchestras.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we were going through
getting,
the progression.
Getting into doing
the progression was work. When you get to the end of the line, and then you hear about the recording industry, which is exactly what happened to me. And from there, my career developed into what it was, which was over 1,000 features over a 30-year period.
Wow.
And a lot of orchestral music. I play, you know, in the New West Symphony where I contract the musicians and that. And I became a contractor as well, hiring the musicians for a lot of other things. And the recording industry was huge. You know, I got called to do Titanic.
Yeah.
And I was happy because I knew it was going to be huge. And the whole film got moved. But the week it got moved to, I was already busy doing a movie with Robin Williams called Flubber. So I had to take Flubber instead of Titanic, which in the residual department was about minus $50,000.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah.
The musicians do get a residual on video sales. Yeah.
Really? Wow. Huh. That's
from
nice.
Features.
That's great.
It's like 1% of gross sales divided by the number of people on a film.
Right, right.
Yeah. What about on-demand sales?
That counts.
Okay.
There's a formula.
And, wow. And for doing television, like when you do The Simpsons and The Animaniacs and all that sort of stuff, do you get residuals?
No. Unless they box it in video and put it in video.
I see.
Like there's been a lot of video sales on Simpsons
right.
by the season. Haven't seen many Animaniacs yet, but it probably will come.
I think it's because the audience for that is probably now at the age where they'd have the money to purchase those
nostalgic
box sets.
And that's really high-end
animation,
I think. I mean, the Animaniacs lineup of, you know, Freakazoid and Pinky and the Brain and History.
Well-written, too.
Yeah, excellent. It was a great, great staff and group they put together to do those shows.
And they were
but the music
nice,
was fantastic
yeah.
in those days.
Yeah,
things.
It was a nice homage to the original Looney Tunes series. Yeah. With
Richard Stone was just, you know, totally enamored and enabled by Stallings.
Yeah.
He would use a lot of Stallings music just to, you know, to memorialize Carl Stallings and his music. You'd always find stuff.
What do you think about the new Looney Tunes rebirth? Have you heard of this?
I'm doing it.
Well, heard of it.
What's happening is, I guess Warner Brothers decided to go back to the old school, putting a cartoon before a feature. Is that what we're talking about?
They're doing two things. They're doing that, but they're also doing a new TV series.
Okay, that I don't know about.
Okay.
Okay. You can be sure there won't be live music, at least at the moment.
The fact that you haven't heard about it maybe already has graded it for me.
Yeah. Me too. Me too. Yeah.
But the cartoon before the feature, they started with one. It's a Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw a still from it.
Okay. Yeah. And they decided to have an orchestra, put it together, and all of a sudden they loved it. I mean, they ordered two more.
Good.
So we did a series of three. It's just a single session. And he gets the whole thing done in 3 hours. And now I've heard they're talking about five more.
Wow.
What's it like being in the orchestra, having the conductor, and also seeing the scene play on a screen? Or do you do that?
Well, we can see this, especially if there's a projected image on the back screen. We can see it. But now most of the time, I'd say about 80% of the time, it's video. So he's got a monitor in front of him. We can't see it.
Okay.
We'll see it on playback.
All right. So he's looking at probably time code.
He's got time code. He's got also another screen with just bar count on it.
Oh, wow.
Because a lot of these composers aren't great conductors.
Right.
And that's another thing, that whether the producer's willing to hire
a
conductor
at
triple scale just to conduct.
So the composer is conducting.
Sometimes.
Yeah, no, I'd say more than half the time. A guy like Silvestri doesn't conduct. Mm. Conti does conduct. Williams does conduct. Horner does conduct. So a lot of the big guys do. Mm. Giacchino does not. He's the hot ticket in Hollywood, although he took a year off. He got so rich. and won an Academy at the same time. Yeah. But he didn't conduct. Okay. He didn't get close to the podium at all.
Have you ever thought about composing?
No.
It's never been an interest.
No, never been a thing. I mean, playing violin, you know, to getting to the level that I achieved over my career has been enough work for a lifetime.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, computer has another question.
Yeah, shoot.
He wants to know what your favorite piece to play is. Of all time.
My favorite classical piece?
Yeah.
Mahler's Second Symphony. If you can get through the Mahler Second Symphony and the final finale and all the whole thing with the choral thing without getting moved by it, then it's a special, special thing.
So, we're just going to put you on the spot. Okay. Play something for us. Break it out.
I could warm up a little.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have to.
Would you do that?
Yeah, I could play a few notes.
I think we should.
How much would we have to pay for the ASCAP residuals?
Oh, yeah. Hold on a second.
I secretly got 1.5-4 kids.
Is this your good violin?
Yeah,
or?
This is my good and best violin.
What is it?
It's a J.B. Vion violin, French, about 1860.
Wow.
Whoa.
I've had it 40 years.
Yeah. That sounds good. Nice.
Wow. The whole time I was just picturing Plucky Duck fighting somebody with
that'll work. We did that plenty of times, you know.
Yeah.
Can you play Beat It?
That's not Beat It, but that's from the album.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Thriller, yeah.
Oh, that's from Thriller.
The greatest rhythm section of all time, I think.
Well, great.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, is there any website you want to promote?
Yeah, anything to plug other than you'll be able to hear me in your local theater?
There's an orchestra called the New West Symphony, which is struggling. It's like about $1.5 to $2 million a year orchestra. And I hire the musicians, I play in it, and they're undergoing some serious financial problems. Hmm. They're working on it. I mean, how many times can you go back to the same whales?
Right.
But New West Symphony in Thousand Oaks is... They have a website, newwestsymphony.org.
Okay.
And we're scheduled to do a season, hopefully without a deficit.
Yeah.
But they're working on it.
Well, thanks for letting us swing
Michael
by
Markman
put you on tape.
Yes, and being such
a
great
happy
host.
To do it. We should all be told that, you know, Alan and I are cousins.
Yeah.
And this is even better.
Yeah.
Yeah, that we can do something together.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, everyone. Michael Markman.
Good job. Yeah. Thank you very much.
You want to play us out as we clap? A little over the clapping.
A little romantic music.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Don't cry.
This is my favorite.
Okay, so Alan.
Yeah.
I think it's time to bring out Sheila and David. Computer, summon them. Here they are, coming in from the massive LA Acme Filmworks Studios green room. How has it been so far?
Exciting.
Yeah. What do you see?
I'm trying to decide if it's actually green. It's kind of a off color white.
Yeah.
Green.
It's pretty far from green.
How was the traffic in the green room?
Traffic getting to the green room?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was stop and go the whole way. Boy. There were some accidents.
Hollywood
and...
Bowl traffic.
Yeah.
So, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And we're very excited to have you here to talk about anything and everything. It can deal with animation. It doesn't have to deal with animation. Yeah. But maybe we'll start with the topic of animation, because both of you work in animation, with it and around it.
For it and on it.
And just tell us, maybe we can start off quick bios.
Should we do sort of a joint bio?
You want to start?
Sure. Yeah. Dave and I both, well, we met each other at the Rhode Island School of Design.
Good
and,
place.
He was a couple years ahead of me. I graduated in 85 and he graduated.
And I graduated in 83.
Yeah.
But I actually started at Brown University.
Oh. Uh-oh.
And exhausted their production facilities pretty quickly because they only had one filmmaking class at the time. And I had an art studio major friend who said, hey, you know, we can take classes down at the art school at the base of the hill and get credit for them. And that started me on the road to animation.
Wow.
So, yeah. So then, you know, Dave taught at RISD for a while. And eventually, we actually both ended up going to CalArts for grad school. I went there first on a fellowship and persuaded Dave to come down a year later. And so we graduated from there. And then, and so we were making films along the way, or, you know, associated with undergraduate and graduate degrees. And then I got a job in Philadelphia teaching at the University of the Arts. And I was there for 5 years. Mm. And then I made my first kind of big film after graduating called Survivors, an animated documentary on domestic violence. And then, oh, go ahead.
Well, then basically after we'd been there for 5 years, I got a call from he was still a friend, actually, a former classmate from CalArts who, because at CalArts I had done some stop motion films, he had a friend who needed somebody to come out to LA and work on a stop motion project for a couple of weeks. So I flew out to LA and did that. And when it was all over, they said, well, you know, this thing is actually a TV show, and when it starts up in the fall, would you be interested in coming and working on it? And at that point, we had sort of decided that maybe it was time to move on from Philadelphia, so I accepted the job.
So he took that job, and it was great, except that then I got this great fellowship called the Pew Fellowship, which is $50,000, and the only requirement is that you stay in Pennsylvania for a year. So for 1 year, he was in L.A., and I was in Pennsylvania, and I eventually joined him. And then, so he's been pretty much working on and off in the industry since then, and I worked in the industry for a while, and then I got a job at College of the Canyons, which is a community college down the street from CalArts, and I created a couple of AA degrees and certificates in animation there. I chaired their program for 5 years, and then I was recruited to come to USC, so now I'm at USC. I'm an associate professor there. And Dave's been kind of bouncing
depending
around.
On, you know, the work environment, I'll work on either TV shows or web stuff. I was actually on staff at Warner Brothers in their internet division for 7 years, which was like, it was supposed to be a 3-month job that basically just kept going. And it was right at the beginning of the .com bubble. So it was good that I was with a company that had relatively deep pockets. So when they folded all the other divisions, they still maintain a staff of people. But when things get slow, sometimes I'll bounce back into academia. So I've actually taught at USC and I've taught at CalArts. And I think that's all out here anyway.
Yeah. Although Mission and...
Yeah, I mean, wherever they need somebody to be goofy with a camera. Yeah.
And I continue to make films. I made a film, a painting on glass animated film called A Conversation with Harris, where I interviewed a young Bosnian boy about the war. And then I made a not an animated documentary, but more of a political film called Waving the Flag about patriotism and flag worshiping. And then, the last few years I've been working on this huge, ambitious project called Truth Has Fallen, that is a documentary on people wrongfully convicted of murder, and it combines animation and live action. And I'm picking up a role tonight at the lab that's almost the very end of the animation after all this time. And I just have one more scene to do and then a little bit more live action, and then after 10 years of working on this film, I'll be done.
Wow. So on film you're picking it up.
Yes, yeah. my animation is on 16 millimeter and the live action is on 35, so I have to blow up the 16.
Wow.
So in fact, you're still shooting on the animation stand that we built back in Rhode Island.
Yep. Frame, yeah, and I won't even use a video assist. I'm doing all painting on glass animation. Dave tries to get me use
a video
assist.
She just goes straight ahead because the video assist would slow her down.
I just like being blind, you know, not knowing what it looks like until 3 months later. Yeah.
Yeah. That builds a different set of timing skills in your head that I have been trying to weave into the minds of students now.
Yes, and it's great that you understand that. It's hard to communicate, you know, why that's important, but it really it is helpful because when you're working blind like that, you have to get it right the first time.
Yeah, so. And you're more likely to go with it.
Yes. Be spontaneous.
It becomes what it wants to be.
That's right.
Now, along the way, something else happened in your history. You guys got married.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, so we are an animation couple. Yes. Yeah.
Yes, that happened after we graduated from RISD. We actually moved to Maine to help his parents run an inn for a year. And nice. And then we got married at the inn. It was great. Yeah. We saved our money and were able to accommodate people.
And our fill of snow.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you think that animators make good married couples?
Well, we know a few of them. There's Steve Sabotnick and Amy Kravitz.
Good folks.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. They're a wonderful couple.
Yeah.
We actually have a couple of former students who were in animation together.
Kieran and Chris?
Yeah, who are and married now.
That's true.
Well, mm-hmm. If nothing else, animation makes you patient, I guess. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the kind of work we do is actually very different. You know, I do the dark, depressing stuff, and he does the funny, light stuff.
Or as I say, she does the socially conscious stuff, and I do the stupid stuff.
but he offers great advice, and I really respect his opinion, and all of my films are so much better because of his input. And, you know, both technically he helps me, you know, as well as creatively. So I think for me, it works very nicely. And he's actually getting back into working on his own stuff, too.
So. Mm. Have you collaborated on something ever?
Once.
And how did it go?
There's a feature film called Closet Land that Dave and I both did animation for, starring Madeline Stowe and Alan Rickman.
Okay.
What happened to Madeline Stowe?
That's yeah.
That's a good question.
Yeah. She was on a roll.
Yeah.
So she'd still do makeup commercials?
Probably.
So, yeah. So there was 45 seconds of animation in there, and Dave and I collaborated on that. That was when we were still at CalArts.
Yeah. I think it was over a summer.
The problem, though, with collaborating is that you're living and breathing it all the time, so you don't get away from it. So, you know, dinner table and everywhere you go, you're discussing this. And I don't know, I kind of like, you know, separating a little bit.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about what you're currently working on. So, Sheila, you're making documentary animation or animated documentaries.
That's correct.
Socially conscious and maybe even, would you say, human rights oriented?
Yeah, my films usually are in that general area.
What made you go into that arena?
Well, it's hard to say. I like to say there's not enough conflict in my life, so I have to find it in my films. Wow. I don't know. That's just a theory. But I don't know. I'm just drawn to it. I mean, you find a story that is compelling, and then you want to, you know, to tell the world. And this particular film started with a newspaper article that I read of James McCloskey, who runs his Centurion Ministries in Princeton, New Jersey. And it's this nonprofit organization where they go and reinvestigate cases of people that they think are innocent, and they get lawyers working pro bono. And this article I read was about him. He was walking hand in hand with this guy named Eddie Baker, who had been in prison for 25 years. And I was amazed that this guy was in prison for 25 years, and there's all this evidence proving that he was innocent, and he had served all that time. And I was also amazed at James McCloskey's story, that he spent his life helping people like him. And so that was when the internet was just starting, 1995. I had like a text-only internet, so I found his phone number and I contacted him. And he agreed to let me interview him, and he put me in touch with Eddie Baker and James Landano and Joyce Ann Brown, three different people who had spent time in prison whose convictions had been overturned. It, you know, it definitely required a lot of research.
Yeah, I can see why it's taken 10 years to, to get to the point you're at.
I'm sorry.
No.
So when the people who were in prison are talking, then it's animated painting on glass animation. Mm-hmm. And then when the experts are talking, then it's live action, kind of surreal Errol Morris kind of staged cinematography.
What do you think you can achieve with an animated documentary versus a straight up doc?
I think animation allows you to get sucked in to an extent that you can't with live action in some ways. You're kind of interpreting what they're saying and how they're perceiving things. And it really allows you to feel it on a very empathetic way, you know? So I think I've gotten very strong reactions from some, especially survivors. I've been surprised, and a conversation with Harris, I've been surprised at the reactions I received, because making the film, you know, survivors took 4 years, it was 10,000 drawings, and so you become immune to the subject matter. But when I projected it, it's a 16-minute film, people would be in tears, and I was really surprised, but I don't think they expect to get that kind of visceral reaction from it. And some people told me that they were allowed to empathize more with the people because they didn't see what they look like, and they couldn't judge them based on their appearance. Right. And so they kind of listened more carefully and, you know, really imagined what they were going through.
I noticed that with looking at your work, and Caroline Leaf also has this quality too, that the fluidity of that and how you can even morph from one visual idea to the next feels very much like how a dream might play out.
Right.
And also thoughts, they kind of swim that idea, and it's that actual technique combined with the fact that it is animated, like what you were saying, really does allow people to feel it a different way.
Right.
As opposed to Lego animation. Hard to pull off.
Which would be more in my venue.
Yes, yes. Speaking of which, tell us what you do and how you do it.
Well, it depends about when you're talking about. When I'm working professionally now, for the last couple of years, I've sort of fallen into cutting animatics for animated properties. The previous gig I had was working for a studio that was doing the Ricky Gervais show for HBO, which is, you know, based on his very, very popular podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So now, I know you know this because you've heard all of our episodes. Yeah. We have a beef with Gervais.
Oh, whoa. You have a beef.
Okay, I have a beef with
Don't let me
Gervais.
In.
I'm curious.
Yeah. Okay. It's very simple. Very simple.
He won't come on your show?
Oh, no. He's begged. Yeah. He's begged. I said, until you come in on my terms, you will not be on.
Oh,
but the idea of a podcast being a visual thing that you use your imagination.
I see.
Like old radio days, I feel like Gervais is just spoon-feeding me something that I don't need to see. And then the question was, would we ever animate our podcast?
Uh-huh.
And the question remains a question.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a challenge in a certain way. I mean, I, for me, I was not familiar with the Gervais material prior to working on the show, which, you know, and I knew of him, but I'm not an Office fan or anything like that. So my exposure to him was fairly minimal. But I have to say, while I was cutting the animatics, I was always laughing my head off because the podcasts are hilarious.
Yeah.
And the people who I was working with, you know, to their credit, you know, like you say, it's kind of like, was it Chuck Jones who used to say, "Why, that's nothing more than illustrated radio or something," when he would talk about, limited animation with talking heads. But they really, you know, the people on it really tried to push it in a certain sense to be design-wise very sort of Fred Flintstone-y.
Yeah.
But most of the crew, most of the animation people were actually formerly from Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends.
And
the first season was done entirely here in LA, which is kind of unusual for any animation production because it was done in Flash.
Mm-hmm.
I know they've been picked up for a second season, but I don't know if that's going to hold true or whether they're going to go with an overseas studio or exactly, you know, what's going to happen. So the animation, although quote-unquote limited, as most television animation is probably among the better you're going to find because there's a lot of care that goes into
it. It's well done.
Yeah. And, you know, again, you know, it did seem a little bit like somebody said, wow, this thing is really popular. How can we wring more money out of it?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, it's not like I, you know, don't go on the internet and don't, you know, subscribe to various things, but I just wasn't familiar with the work. So it is a way to expose other people to this very funny material.
Yeah.
And again, for me, having worked in the industry recently, you know, for the last 10 years on and off, 90% of the stuff you're going to work on is going to be very kid-oriented. So it's always great when, you know, they can curse.
And
they can, you know, basically make things that are more appealing to adults in certain ways. And by that, I don't mean they don't just, you know, necessarily go the crass route just for shock value like certain other entities on
or
cable.
Or the Krauss route.
Yeah, it's either that too.
Alan,
I was going to ask if you could describe what cutting an animatic is for people who don't know.
Yeah, well, basically, it's taking the storyboard after the, and depending on the show, but most shows are scripted first. So you get a written script, and then it's given to a storyboard artist or artists, and their job is to, you know, make cartoon strips of it, basically, like the Sunday Funnies. And they give you indications as to where the dialogue should fall and whether there are camera moves. But anyway, once you get that stack of drawings, it gets digitized and brought into an editing program. And at first on Gervais, we did the first two, I think, in Flash, mainly because the board artists were working in Flash and it was just the easiest way to go.
Right.
But then moving ahead, a lot of people were doing it in Photoshop. So I ended up learning more about Final Cut than I ever had before, and that's the software I've been using. So then we would, you know, basically time out everything that was drawn, sync it up to the sound, and then it goes to the various entities who have to approve it before it goes to the next stage.
Does Ricky approve?
He was one of the people, and I have to say to his credit, he was the greatest, because you would, you know, the notes you would get back from him would be like four, you know, it's a 22-minute episode and you get like four things like don't do this, do this, lose this.
Did he also just write out his laugh phonetically?
I don't know. I mean, like I don't think up? It was weird because it's not like somebody actually created the script. It was more like they had to hire people to transcribe it. And sometimes it was hilarious because of the thick English accents, the people who were transcribing it, I don't know what country they were from, but they didn't always get it correct. So you'd get something written and you go, what? That doesn't make sense. That's not a sentence.
That's
and then you'd hear it and you go, oh, okay, now I understand what they're saying.
That's why I like to watch things just on closed captioning. I don't like to listen to the audio.
It also teaches you how to read.
Mm-hmm.
Sheila, you mentioned that David, or Dave. Do you go by Dave?
I go by both.
All right. David is working on something new of his own?
Yes, that's right. It's very exciting. It's reminiscent of Oral Hygiene, a very popular short that he did.
Was that your stop motion film from CalArts?
Yes, that's fabulous singing and dancing skeletons talking about brushing your teeth.
Very nice.
And I, you know, I haven't made a stop motion piece. I made another stop motion film after that at CalArts, which is very dark and sort of Eastern European and has no dialogue and it has no dancing or singing. But this latest piece is something that I started for a contest. There's a band called Pink Martini.
Yes.
Yes, we were just talking to J.J. Villard about that.
Yeah.
Band.
Well, I unfortunately, basically, I'm kind of a fan of theirs, and I saw on their website that when they released their latest album, they said, we're going to release these six tracks, and we want our fan base to make music videos to them. And at that point in time, I was unemployed, so I was like, okay, I like cutting to, you know, I like working to music. So the other thing you need to know about me is that I'm very much kind of like the character from the first Toy Story movie, Sid,
the one who kills the toys, basically.
Yeah. My garage is filled with, you know, it's the killing fields, basically, of dismembered dolls and action figures. So I decided I wanted to tackle one of these tracks that they had, which is purely an instrumental, and I wanted to do something sort of in a Busby Berkeley kind of dance number. And I decided I would limit myself to Green Army Men as the dancers, but they had a little caveat in the contest rules that said, please, no violent imagery. So I've been cutting off the guns with X-Acto knives. And also, it also works better that way because what I'm basically doing is replacement animation with army men sequencing them so that they're looking like they're doing dance moves.
Right, right.
And I'm kind of expanding the palette a little bit because the track is almost 5 minutes long. Ooh. To other plastic molded kinds of like cowboys and Indians. Mm-hmm. I think I have some spacemen and aliens. They haven't really come in yet, but I'm kind of keeping them in as my when I run out of interesting army men poses. Although I've been amazed at how many I've been able to find at the local swap meets that are of different ethnic origins and different colors. Yeah. And
are you a fan of the Peak Andre folks? The Panic in the Kitchen.
The Belgian film? Yeah. The Indian, the cowboy, and the horse.
Yeah.
I haven't seen their feature. I've been really dying to see it, but I missed it when it was here in L.A.
It's just pure playing. It's just playing with toys.
Yeah, I've seen some of the shorts. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's, you know, again, I can remember being a child and sitting in front of the TV and, you know, manipulating these little characters. So that's how you end up being an animator, I guess. You just never stop.
Sheila.
Yes.
What do you teach at USC?
I teach, I've taught a 2D a computer animation class for junior undergrads. And until this year, I taught Production 1 class for graduate students where they worked on film. But that's last semester was the last semester we worked on film.
Wow.
We're moving into a new building now. It's a department we decided to no longer teach on film, although students can still work on it if they want. We still have our Oxbury. So I've been teaching that. I've also taught the undergraduate senior class, helping mentor the students with their final projects. Last year, I was actually chair of the program for a year, but I'm going back to teaching and trying to finish my film this year.
And you're going to be teaching a documentary animation
class.
That's
right. I actually designed a documentary animation class. I'm very excited about that, actually. Thanks for reminding me. That was fun because I've lectured all over the world and taught documentary animation, but I've never taught it as a class, and I've never taught at USC. And I have students who are very interested in it, and so this is a great opportunity.
The research I've done lately in getting grants, I'm finding a lot of opportunities for animated documentaries.
Yeah, you know, animated documentaries actually has the advantage of the subject matter because a lot of times you'll have foundations or organizations that who really want to support certain
point
causes.
Of view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there are certain, I've had some success with grants, but recently I haven't. But I'm trying to get post-production funding, and also the last live action shoot. So I've been applying to quite a few. So there are opportunities out there. I just haven't gotten them yet, but hopefully, you know, one of them will come through.
There's a big granting institution in New England that used to have a separate category just for experimental films, which animation fell under. They got rid of it.
Huh.
And they're just doing doc, but they have animation documentaries that they fund.
It's finally becoming a thing, which is so cool. And it's nice when Waltz with Bashir came out.
Yes.
That was sort of the first mainstream animated documentary that people kind of, now you don't have to explain exactly
right.
what animated documentary is.
Persepolis too.
Exactly. So it's great. It's a real thing. And there are all these animated documentary programs at different festivals. I think actually Anima Mundi right now is having an animated documentary program. Mm. And I was in a panel at Doc Leipzig in Germany on animated documentary. And they had a huge retrospective where they showed a lot of animated documentaries. And they're from all over the world. And, you know, there are some filmmakers that make several, like Dennis...
Topakov.
Thank you. Dennis Topakov from Australia.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who, you know, are just coming at it for the first time, doing really interesting work.
Chainsaw.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And he did the Dara Dogs and His Mother's Voice, which are really well-known anime documentaries.
Where can people go to see your work, whether in real life or on the internet?
Well, my films, Survivors is distributed educationally, and A Conversation with Harris is on a DVD collection, and I also sell the DVDs myself. They're not online, although I did discover Survivors was online without my permission.
Oh.
Did it not survive?
Yeah.
But the only film that's actually online is Waving the Flag. That is online. And I have a trailer for the film I'm working on now, an 8-minute trailer. That's online.
I saw it.
Wow.
It's really good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And what's your website?
Truthhasfallenmovie.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I have SheilaSophian.com as well.
David?
Well, Oral Hygiene was distributed by the Tournée of Animation on VHS, but I don't believe that they've ever... I'm trying to remember which one it was. I want to say the sixth annual, but I could be wrong. It is on my blog, which I'm trying to remember, which I think is davidbfain.com.
He doesn't update it very often.
I don't go there very often. You know, you could see a little spot I did for Wild Brain Studios. It's on Vimeo. If you type in Endangered Dunnies, and Dunnies is D-U-N-N-Y-S, I believe, which is a toy from Kid Robot. That was a really fun thing. That was probably the most recent stop motion thing I've done.
And Dave also directed and wrote like 13 episodes of Action League Now.
Oh,
and,
right.
That's right.
And he was a writer on SpongeBob. That's and right. He did a lot of stuff. You wrote for Looney Tunes at Warner Brothers Online.
Yeah, those were internet cartoons that probably have passed into the ether at this point. I don't think they're posted anywhere. You're better off looking me up on the web, and you'll probably hit my blog, which I haven't updated in a long time.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And computer will show you out. Sheila Sophian and David Fain. Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that is that.
Very
you know
well said.
You know what I mean?
That reminds me of a scene in Rambo.
First Blood?
No, the most recent one. What was that one called? That one was just called...
It was called Rambo.
It was just called Rambo, right?
Rambo.
Or Rambo. Yeah. There was a scene where he's on a boat.
Yeah.
He's like living in some... He's living near Burma.
Sure.
Something like that.
Yeah.
He's like... He's got cages full of snakes. He just holds snakes, has snakes, I think. He's snake man.
Was he... Were they...
But anyway, he's on a boat.
Yep.
And he gets in this big, deep... philosophical conversation with you know, one of the people who might or might not die over the course of the film.
Okay.
And you know, the gist of it was, what is, what was is, what is.
We'll see you in April.